Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 5th, 2002. This session is Helping Tools for Ourselves and Others, found through loss, healing stories from Scripture and everyday sacredness. Your presenter is Dr. Nancy C. Reeves, REN 2002-09. Let's listen in.
When we're thinking about grief and loss and trauma, what psalm springs to mind?
23rd?
62. Yeah, 62.
27.
Psalms of comfort? 46. Yeah. And that's, I'm not going to read those.
We didn't give the right answer.
No, there's no right answer. But it's very interesting to me when I do workshops for churches, lay and professional helpers around grief and loss, and I say, you know, you've gone out and you're with, you know, companioning people who are hurting, and they ask you to read from the Bible, and you say, what would you like me to read? And what's their normal response? And you'll say, the 23rd Psalm. And I say, why do you think they asked for that? I mean, it's a beautiful psalm, and it's a wonderful word of comfort. But probably because it's the only number they know. And that is wonderful if that's the space you're in. If you are in touch with God's comfort and God's healing, or are really asking for that. But sometimes you feel different things. And if you are raging and you are in a, and you know it's not Christian, but you want God to smash your enemies or smash this illness or whatever, then to read the 23rd Psalm might be kind of a violation of where you're at. You know, it pushes down those feelings and they don't go away. Somebody was asking me about the anger, the part of anger and grieving. And emotions like anger are very healthy emotions. They give us some information about our needs in the grieving process. If we allow their expression, if we can even to ourselves say, I am angry, and it's wonderful to be able to say to God, I am angry, then by knowing that, we can allow God's healing to come and direct us to how to meet our needs in the anger, which is not smashing our enemies. But we may need to get that out. If we don't acknowledge it, I'm a good Christian, I don't feel angry, the anger doesn't go away. It gets pushed down, it festers, and then it becomes what I call an expensive emotion. It turns into to bitterness or to vengeance, to revenge, and that moves us to either violence towards ourselves or violence to others. So allowing the emotion really informs us and helps us to meet our needs. Denying it or glorifying it. I have a right to be angry, and you know, I have a right to have all of the obstacles moved out of my path, and I'm going to stomp on them, or I'm going to ask God to stomp on them. But way better to read one of the Psalms that say, crush my enemies, stomp on them, you know, smash their children's heads against the ground, because we know God's not going to do it, right? But if we say that to a friend or a family member or to some other part of society or to our government, they might do it. They might do something like that. So God's safe, real safe to have a hissy fit with. God will hold you in love, won't do it, and then you'll be able to work it through. So this is a psalm that often people like because it really expresses some of the pain that they're in. When they think that maybe God doesn't realize how much pain I'm in and has to be told. So let's pray. Psalm 102. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Let my cry come to you. Do not hide your face from me in the day of my distress. Incline your ear to me. Answer me speedily in the day when I call. For my days pass away like smoke, and my bones burn like a furnace. My heart is stricken and withered like grass. I am too wasted to eat my bread. Because of my loud groaning, My bones cling to my skin. I'm like an owl of the wilderness, like a little owl of the waste places. I lie awake. I am like a lonely bird on the housetop. All day long, my enemies taunt me. Those who deride me use my name for a curse. For I eat ashes like bread and mingle tears with my drink. Because of your indignation and anger, for you have lifted me up and thrown me aside. My days are like an evening shadow. I wither away like grass.
It's so eloquent, you know. I'm like a little bird, a little owl, and withered grass, you know.
That's how we feel sometimes in our grieving. And then that little, you know, and you did it, God, you know, stop, please. But to be able to put that out can be so healing and helpful for a lot of people. And something like the 23rd Psalm at that point might push those feelings down. We need to allow them expression.
What Psalm was it used
to? 102.
102.
Yeah. There's a number of wonderful ones in there. What I suggest to people who go in as visitors and have a sense that they know somebody is going to ask them to read for them is to have a number and just to say, well, what are you feeling right now? What message would you like to get through to God? Do you want God to know how painful this is right now? Or are you asking for comfort? Or, you know, are you angry? Or are you, you know, feeling despairing? Oh God, why have you forsaken me? You know, to be able to get that out often lets it. Because it feels so much better to be given permission to do that. The scriptures are wonderful. Let's turn on the... and I forgot, but if the tape's not running, please turn it on. Aha! Oh, I see, it's up. You have to pull up the top. No,
that's
up
right.
Where the light is.
The light.
That has to
come
down.
Tilt the lens.
Down, keep going down.
There.
Yes, perfect. Okay. Now, helping tools need to be holistic. We need a wide range of self-care strategies for ourselves and for others in the grieving process. And I find that very often people get kind of in a rut with them. I had one young man who said, well, I have lots of different strategies. I jog, or I chop wood, or I run, or I play basketball. Or I say, well, that's great. That's all on the physical level, though. And if I am feeling burdened in my heart, and I could go out and run, if I could, for 10 miles, and I'm not going to feel much release. My body will feel exhausted, but my heart will still be heavy. Maybe I need to go and talk to someone, share that pain, or I might need to be held, or maybe I need to read something that's comforting, or to listen to something that's comforting. If my spirit hurts, if I'm saying, why do people do things like that to people, or if it seems to be a spiritual issue, then I need to pray, or I need to read scripture, or I need to meditate, or I need to worship, or I need to do something that will feel like it's touching me on that level. Because again, I could talk to a friend for hours and it wouldn't relieve it. So we need to have a variety of self-care strategies and then be able to ask ourselves when we're hurting, what dimension am I hurting in? Maybe it's all four. So I need to do a variety of things. I had an experience once. I'm a great one for bubble baths. I'll get into a bubble bath and just kind of be there. And it just feels like I'm being held and comforted and loved. And I work a lot with people who've been in motor vehicle accidents and now are in litigation around that. And I had been dealing with lawyers all day. Now, I like lawyers, but I was really hurting for this person who I felt didn't have people who were really advocating for him. And I got into bed and I was sitting there, I was kind of fuming about this, and I thought, oh, I gotta do something, I gotta have a bubble bath. I went into the bathroom, it was a Tuesday night, so it was cheap movie night, and my husband and daughter were off out of the house, and I walked into the bathroom and I noticed the towel was damp and the bathtub was damp. Huh. Either somebody snuck in and had a bubble bath in my bathtub, or I had one and I wasn't even present for it. And that's what happens if we are choosing the right healing or healthy strategy. You know, have you ever driven somewhere and thought, I've been driving for 20 minutes and I can't remember a bit of the route? Am I not the only one, right? So, if we do a self-care strategy, we need to be present to it, and it needs to be in the dimension that we are hurting. We need the help. And so to have a range, and I suggest that people write down strategies. In my book, I have a section for that on these four dimensions that you can use daily, some that you might use when the pain gets particularly intense, some you might use ever so often as real, because they may be more expensive or time consuming. You know, we can't, most of us dash up to Holden every week for a break or weekend, but we can maybe come once a year. And so it's something that we're planning that gives us hope. Okay, let's move down to the There are three kinds of help for people who are grieving. If you look at this as like an inverted triangle, the base of the triangle now is support. Most people need and want support when they're grieving. And I see support as having two aspects to it. One is someone who will be an ally for you, who essentially will be God with skin on. Someone who will offer you unconditional love, support. That doesn't mean accepting every behavior. If I say, I'm going to go off and kill myself in this pain, you don't say yes, you feel like you want to kill yourself. So I won't judge the worth of the person, but I may judge an action or an attitude that I believe is going to be really destructive to themselves or to others. But having an ally is so important. The second aspect of support, I believe, is the provision of information. If I understand the grieving process and how it's a healing process, if I understand that my loss is legitimate, because maybe I'm saying, well, you know, it's just the loss of a dream, that's no big deal. And if somebody can say, that is, for if it hurts, then it's real, and we need to honor it. Someone who could give me information about how children grieve, or some resources in town, like, you know, large print books if my eyesight is going. Information can be so empowering. That's different than advice. Advice is saying, well, if I were you, you know, I would get large print books. I haven't been asked about that, but I just think the person should do it. That's an invasion. That's intrusive. You know, even if it's right, even if, yeah, it would be a good idea for them to do that, they don't feel like they have been honored as a decision-making person. People who are grieving, a lot of professionals will say, but they don't concentrate well. They don't, now their short-term memory is terrible, and they don't make decisions well. So, you know, I have to. I did a study as part of my doctoral program of bereaved parents, and I asked them a number of questions about the death of their child, and I asked, did you see your child's body after death? And if so, how did that happen? Did you decide? Did someone else decide for you? How did you feel then? How do you feel now? Some of this was 10 years after. The shortest was a year after the death. It didn't matter so much whether the person actually viewed or didn't view the child's body. What mattered was that they made the decision to do it. Some people said, I decided to view, but my doctor said I shouldn't, or my husband said I shouldn't, it would upset me, or the other way around, and I resent that. I wish I'd been able to make my own decision. Some of them said, and you know, actually, my husband was right. But still, I felt like it was the power was taken away from me. Most people who had made the decision said they felt good about it years later. The few that didn't said, yeah, I really wish I hadn't, or I really wish I had, but I can forgive myself. I was young, I didn't know. But it's really hard to forgive someone else who says, I know better than you. And yet the professionals I sometimes work with say, but it would take too long. It would take too long to find out what they want. I say, usually not. You watch the body language. You watch just how the person comes across to you. If I say, you know, some parents like to see their child's body and some don't, it's up to you. I can help you by giving you some information about that. Sometimes the person right away will say, I want to see, or no, I don't. Sometimes they'll say, well, I guess I should. And I'll say, well, it sounds like, you know, maybe you're not really wanting to. Like part of you is, well, I'm kind of scared what she might look like. I say, would it help you if I tell you what she looks like? And then you can make a decision. Yeah, actually. You know, so it usually doesn't take more than a couple of minutes to work through something like that. And what the person is left with is, I am vulnerable, but I'm not fragile. And I can make decisions in my pain. And it gives them faith and trust in the healing process of grief. And then they don't have to push away the pain in order to become good decision makers. They can make it through the pain. Right? Jesus did not have to push away his pain in order to open to his compassion. He did it through his pain. He expressed his pain first on the cross and then could move into compassion. He didn't try to push it down and say, I'm above all that. He was hurting. So that's support. And most people need support. In fact, people who, as we talked yesterday, allow the grieving process and allow themselves to face the loss often don't move into some of the disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder. Some people don't need counseling. They have an image of the grieving process or their loss that will not let them heal. Maybe they believe bad things don't happen to good people. So this bad thing has happened in my life, that must mean I'm bad. And they start punishing themselves. Or they might believe strong men don't cry. And I'm crying. Something like that that gets in the way of their healing. They won't allow the grieving process to do its work. And so you can give this person all the support that you can, and it's not going to change that central belief. They'll feel good while they see you, and then when you're gone, those demons come back. So what they need is someone who is trained to help look at those images, look at those messages, and move into them and explore them. Where'd they come from? What do they mean to you? And allow some light to shine on them so that they can be transformed. And so there are a number of counselors, some pastors who have pastoral counseling certificates that can do that. Then there's psychotherapy. And with our triangle, this is the tip. Not nearly as many people need psychotherapy as need support or counseling. These people are not saying, life was fine until this loss happened, and then the message of it means that I can't move to healing. They are saying, this is the last straw. Like, I've had it. I've had one bad thing after another happen, or I am a really broken reed. I'm not able to heal, I'm stuck. And to focus on this particular loss is kind of a red herring. The person has a whole pattern of attitudes and behavior. You know, I'm worthless, or I deserve to be punished, or something. And they need a psychotherapist who is trained to be able to look at the whole pattern of their life and help them change their attitudes and change their behaviors to move on with some freedom. And you know, that's what a good psychotherapist is able to do, is to teach new attitudes and behaviors that will free the person. So So if you know somebody who really needs psychotherapy, they're saying, you know, this is the last straw. I don't know how I'm going to get through this. But I don't want to see shrink. That's terrible. I'll just pray about it a lot. God saying, see someone, we're closing our ears. Giving them support might actually be a disservice. Now, I'm not saying withdraw support. But if the person thinks, well, I've got you, and you're so supportive, it's not changing anything. And as long as I'm with you, I feel somewhat better. But then I go home, and I'm back with the heaviness. And at some point, I think, I guess I can't be helped. And I start to become helpless and hopeless. And then I am more likely to reach out to drugs and alcohol to try to push down the pain or feel suicidal or try to find something that is going to tell me how to live. And that's when I'm really open to cults and something that says, I know the way for you. And if you just do exactly what I say. It's so strange to me how some people who I talk to later who have been involved with cults say, I didn't want to come under the control of a psychotherapist. So I joined this community and then for the next 5 years, breathed when they said breathe and ate when they said ate. And you know, I've never had somebody do that as my client. So it really, you know, it's often the analogy I use is if I want to do some gardening, I've got to pick the right tool. And it's not one tool is better than another, but it's more appropriate than another. If I have a window box, I'm not going to get my rototiller in there. If I have a huge garden that I'm going to be planting potatoes in, I'm not going to get a small hand spade. And so psychotherapy is a different type of tool for a different purpose. And often explaining that to the person, they're more likely to try it. Let's go for the next one. And please, if there's questions or comments along the way, stop. Okay. I think just before I do that, I want to read you a little story about information and the power of information to help. It's a woman, I know she's 93 now, but at the time she said, I'm 92 years old. Her name is Ada McKenzie, and I've attended Grace Lutheran Church for 38 years. I go to the early family service because I love to see the young people. I have many friends in other faith traditions. I believe we are all one in the Spirit of God, all brothers and sisters together. In 1943, our family was experiencing a great deal of anguish, and we didn't know what to do about it. My husband, Gordon, was an alcoholic. He felt extremely remorseful about his addiction, yet was unable to control it. I was an obstetrics nurse. One New Year's Day, I was on shift when a telephone call came in from my daughter. She said, Mom, Dad's so sick, I don't think he's going to make it. I hung up the phone in despair. What could we do? Just then, Dr. Buffum walked by and wished me Happy New Year. I broke down. He listened and then asked if I would like him to go out to my husband right then. I was very grateful, but didn't know what he could do that we his family hadn't already tried. He left me for a few minutes and then returned with a Dr. McGill. I was told that Dr. McGill had a special interest in alcoholism and wanted to start a group in our city called Alcoholics Anonymous. It was 1943. I shared my pain with him. A few hours later, I finished my shift and went home. Walking into the house, I could see Gordon and the two doctors still in conversation. As my dear husband looked up at me, his face shone with such a great relief. He never took another drink. God gave us the people to help and offered the program that would save Gordon and the family. It wasn't a coincidence that the one doctor in our city who wanted to start an AA group was in the hospital with me that New Year's Day. But if I hadn't shared my pain with him, he wouldn't have been able to assist us. Also, we had to agree to the guidance we received and to do our part in the healing and growth. It's a partnership between us and the Holy Spirit. And in AA, the partnership broadens. The community that develops is truly wonderful. Wounded people helping other wounded people. Gordon and I were married 61 years. When he died, he had been sober and a member of AA for 45 years. So they needed information. And if she hadn't said, I need this, I need something. And it was hard for her, she said, when I was talking to her, that to let someone else know when she burst into tears, her first impulse was to just say, no, no, I don't want to talk about it. But she did. God offers to us if we'll move into it. Symbols. I work a lot with symbols. When you think of God as a symbol of comfort, what word springs to your mind? An image of Jesus or Spirit or Creator God would you see as an image of comfort for you?
A parent.
Sorry?
A parent.
A parent. Yeah, a parent maybe holding you or... Yeah.
Acceptance.
Good shepherd.
Acceptance. Okay. A good shepherd. Leading me when I'm lost.
Laying on of hands.
What, sir?
Laying on of hands.
Laying on of hands. God just laying hands on or others and God's spirit moving through.
Mm-hmm. Tears.
Tears? How, you want to say more about that?
Because the pain of sorrow and loss brings tears, and my spiritual director said, your tears are your prayers. And
yes.
This is a wonderful gift that you gave me.
Wonderful. So my tears, maybe, and mingling with God's tears and this comfort there. Somebody else? Was, sorry?
Love.
Love. God is love. Yes. Many, many, many images and symbols we can have. And if we open to the image that we feel we need at that moment, and yet not hold it tightly, let it change as God speaks to us. That can really help. I ask people what their symbol of comfort is. One little boy came in to see me, and his older sister had died, and he was very upset, and he came and he sat in, and he looked like a very neat and tidy little boy, you know, with slacks and a clean shirt, and I said to him, what makes you feel better? And he said, wearing my Batman t-shirt. I said, how come you're not wearing your Batman t-shirt now? He said, because my mummy said, you can't go to psychologists wearing your Batman t-shirt. But you could go to this psychologist wearing your Batman t-shirt, because obviously that is a comfort symbol for you. Young man, this was very impactful for me. When I was, I think it was about 15, I have the story in my Found Through Loss book. I went to, for a weekend, to a conference, and I think it was L'Arche that set it up, but it was bringing young teens together, some who had mental and physical challenges and some who didn't. And we spent the weekend doing a lot of different activities together. And a group from our school went to this conference. And at one point, an 18-year-old boy with Down syndrome started to share his story. And he said, I have worked for the last few years in a sheltered workshop, and I like it, and I like the people, and I like my job, but I really like music. And I would go into Mr. Alex's music store all the time and listen to the music and buy some music. And one day, Mr. Alexis said, Ben, would you like to work for me cleaning up the store and stocking some shelves, and I could pay you some money for that? And he said, yes, Mr. Alexis, I would really like to do that. He says, well, I would like to have you, Ben, because I know you'd be a hard worker, and I know that you really like music, but you can't bring your bear. And Ben said, but I always bring my teddy bear everywhere I go because he makes me feel better. And when I'm scared, then I hold my bear. He said, well, I know, Ben, but to have some young man like you working in the store, other kids will come in and they'll say bad things to you, and you just can't take your bear. So Ben said, I went home, I felt very sad, and I thought about my bear not coming, and I thought, I can't work in that store. But my friend, and then his worker, who was a couple years older than him, started to speak, and he said, Ben called me and we talked about it, and I thought, well, you know, that's a symbol of comfort, but I think everyone has some symbol of comfort that they wear, you know. I mean, Christians often wear a cross as a symbol of comfort. Could we find another symbol? And so I talked with Ben about that, but Ben said, no, it's got to be my bear. Can't be, I thought, could there be something small? No. He said, so I was riding the subway, this was in Toronto, I was riding the subway thinking about this. Well, as I looked around, I saw a lot of young people going to work, looking very professional, carrying their attaché cases. Symbol of comfort. And in fact, there's probably all sorts of things inside those attaché cases. Like, this was back in the late 60s, so they poured into backpacks at that time, that are comfort symbols. So I said, I went to Ben's parents, and they gave us some money, and we went out, and we got a nice big briefcase, looks very professional, and Ben said, and I put my bear in it. And I know my bear's in there, and I don't have to open it up, but it sits there, and I look at it every so often because I'm working for Mr. Alexis, and then I go on the subway to work, and I have my attaché case, and I talk to the others, and I wonder what's in theirs. And that, you know, when I heard that at age 14, it was very formative for me, and that, you know, that we can enter into a problem with someone and just hold it and just be with it and trust that we'll receive the guidance for that. That's how creative that was. So then when people came to me with, you know, symbols already that were very destructive for them or restrictive, I could remember that and help them. So one woman said to me, the grieving process is like beating your head against a brick wall. Oh, I said, then I imagine any time you feel a surge of pain, you're going to back off. Sure right I am, she said. I said, well, let me tell you about grief. And I told her about it as a healing process and that really the only way out is through. And she said, wow. So she said, so my symbol then is not letting me move through. And I said, no, it's quite powerful. So I said, just be open to a symbol. If you ask for a symbol to come to you that is going to be healthier, I trust that one will come. So she came back the next session. She was an artist. So she drew this. I liked it so much, I had my husband go out and find it, took a picture of it. But if you can see this, she said, the grieving process is like a path running through a dark, winter-deadened forest. Lots of brambles. And I get caught on the brambles, and I trip over the rocks, and I fall in the holes of the path. It hurts. But I have to walk it if I want to get to the meadow with the sun shining. She said, but I have a real choice of how I walk this path. I can do it all by myself, and I'm quite an independent person. I've been trying to do that. But that's like walking it naked. And I get ripped to pieces on the brambles, and I get cut when I fall. Or I can accept the clothing of support that my friends and my family, my faith community, my God, the professionals of my life are all offering me. And then I still get caught and I still fall, but it's not nearly as dangerous, not as much damage is done. She said, so this came to me a few days after our session and I drew it. And then I put it up where I could see it in a number of places in the house. And when I would feel a surge of pain, I would say, ah, I'm falling again on the path, or I'm caught in a bramble. Am I padded enough? And sometimes I'd answer truthfully and say, no, I'm not. And I would then make myself pick up the phone and call the friends who had been saying, please call us when you need us. And I wouldn't do it because I didn't want to bother them. but I would do that. In fact, we even got a code word, and I'd say, I feel naked. Okay, what can I do? Or I would pray, and I'd particularly pray with those psalms that said, I feel like a little bird shivering on the rooftop. I'm naked, God, help me. So it was a wonderful, wonderful transforming of that symbol from beating your head against a brick wall to taking the reality of the pain into account, but also the hope. And knowing that with community, opening to support, I'll be able to get through it. I try not to choose symbols for people because a path for one person would fit for another person, it wouldn't. You know, one person would find that in kind of a guided imagery, they would go to the lake as a symbol of comfort. Someone else, it doesn't like water, and it would be to the mountaintop. So we need to change depending on who the person is. But in one case, I needed to help someone with a symbol, and I was nervous about it, but this woman had come to me a couple of Advents ago. She said that her daughter, who was in her 30s, had died suddenly 9 months earlier of brain aneurysm, and leaving two young kids. And she and her husband were about to fly back east to be with her son-in-law and the children. And she said, every time I think of going back, I burst into tears. And I know I'm going to cry the whole time I'm there. And that's not going to be helpful to me or to them. So I've come to see you. So we talked about her pain, and we talked about how unnatural it is for a child to die before a parent, and you know, all of the wonderful times they've had together. And after about 45 minutes, she said, I'm feeling a lot lighter now. I'm really glad I came. She said, I wish I could put you in my suitcase and take you with me. And I said, well, you can't do that, but the next time we meet, we can look at a symbol that might be helpful for you, that maybe you can put in your suitcase. She said, I leave tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, this always happens right at the end of the session. You know? I said, oh. I said, can you think of a symbol? Well, she's starting to panic because now she's thinking, no, I can't, I can't. Okay, could you give me one? I said, well, I don't like giving people symbols. You got to have a symbol, you know. Now, so what I did was I tried to weave together what I knew about her. I'd asked her about her spirituality. And often folks say to me, I don't have one of those. And I'll say, well, do you have a sense of what a good person is? Oh, yeah, I try to do this and this and this and this. Oh, you got spirituality. You know, I have a way of making meaning of the world. Well, I don't know if there's a God. Well, what does your spirituality say? What kind of person do you try to live? And often, you know, they'll often even recite almost the Ten Commandments to me. I don't believe in God, but, you know, this is what I try to do. And I say everyone has a way of making meaning of the world, and that's our spirituality. Some folks have their spirituality in the structure called a religion, which helps their spirituality blossom. Other folks find, for some reason, that doesn't help them. But we all have a spirituality. And she had said to me, she saw herself as Christian. She didn't go to a church. She was Protestant. But that she felt God was very much with her in her pain. And that was great. She'd also told me that Advent and Christmas were very important to her normally. She got really entered into the season. She loved. She had a beautiful manger scene she put out. She would attend church at that time. But this year, she said, I look at Mary with the baby, and I remember my daughter dead, and I start to cry. And I hear those Christmas carols about joy and peace, and I start to cry. And I just, you know, I'm just pushing it all away. So I had heard that. I said, maybe we could just pray for a little bit about a symbol. Maybe something will come. Okay, she said. We were silent. She said, nothing's coming. Something came to me. I thought, oh God, I hope this is you, because it's kind of pushing my limits as a psychologist a bit. But I said, The image I'm getting is of Mary with baby Jesus, and she said, yeah, I used to love that. And I said, and then it fast forwarded 30 odd years to Mary watching her son at the foot of the cross. And before I could say anything more, she said, Mary's a bereaved mother, like me. Mary's a bereaved mother like me. And her child died too young. Her child died in his 30s, like me. She says, Mary knows what I what I'm going through. She understands me. She said, so when I look at that manger scene, I can remember when my child was born. Not in a manger, but, you know, I can relate. And then Mary can be with me because she knows my pain. So I thought, off she went. Came back a month later. And she said, I said, how was it? She said, Christmas was wonderful and it was painful. And Mary was with me. And she said, and in fact, the Presbyterian minister who lives next door to my son-in-law, who had done the funeral because he came over when the ambulances arrived and said, what can I do to help? And my son said, we don't have a church, could you? And he said, yeah. Came over and said to me, I imagine this is a rough time for you. It's the first Christmas without your daughter. And she says, oh, yeah, it is rough, but Mary's with me. He said, Mary who? Jesus' mom. So a symbol can be so potent as a way of helping.
Nancy,
Just
a question. I need to ask it after such a nice ending, but could it have been that when she said, I'd like to have you in my bag?
Yes.
Could not that have been interpreted as a symbol?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. What when you have an image of me, what is it? Yeah. And it might even be that I could write something for her.
Yeah.
That could help. Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's a really good point. So I try to go with the person's energy. I don't know why I didn't at that point, except that I had remembered her really talking about her spirituality is very comforting to her. And so that was kind of the focus I had. And she said me, but I had heard her say, God's with me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but absolutely. Anything can be a symbol. And in fact, you know, when we see a heart, particularly a heart-shaped box, we tend to think of love, right? But if your best friend's just undergoing open heart surgery, you're going to see that box is going to be totally different. So we've got to not hold on to a symbol and say, it's got to be a comfort to me all the time. Like it could change, allowing our symbols to change. Yeah. Anything you want to say about symbols? Do you want to share one with us?
I have a friend who works at the zoo in Denver, and she meets the buses from kids. This little first grader got off, and all of a sudden she felt something leaning against her and grabbing her leg. And she thought, okay, let's see what's going on here. And he looked at her and he said, I hope you don't mind, but my daddy lets me do this when I get scared.
Oh, hang on as long as you're up to it.
The leg was his
symbol.
Sure.
That's great.
Okay, let's go to the next one. Affirmations. Affirmations are statements, phrases that provide comfort or support or guidance. What are some affirmations that are helpful for you? Whether they're from scripture or from some other writings or something you made up. Yeah?
On the way out here, I found that a close friend of mine died, and the people on the bus put a card together.
Wonderful. Yes. And were there any messages that particularly touched you?
Well, the saying on it was right with all their names.
Great. Can you remember the saying?
No.
No, but it really touched. Yeah. Great. Any that you can't remember that helped?
I know I can't experience what you're experiencing.
Yes.
But I love you.
Ah. Yes. That when someone says that to you, really, they're not trying to say, I know what it's going on for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people will have, you know, if a, I always get this a bit wrong, but a window closes, a door opens somewhere else, or, you know, something like that, or, you know, even every cloud has a silver lining. Now, the thing about affirmations is they're interesting, kind of chameleon-like, in that if I find every cloud has a silver lining myself, and it helps me, I think, great, this is a source of comfort. So then you're grieving, and I say, I want to give you a gift. I'm going to give you my beautiful affirmation. But if I say to you, you know, every cloud has a silver lining, do you imagine how you'd feel?
No.
Right. It feels like I'm trying to take your pain away or diminish it, you know, minimize it, tell you, you know, if you just take this, you'll be all right. Don't give anybody an affirmation. Try to, like, you know, something like that where you're giving an opening. Some cards really do hit. They feel really good. But it's my tendency is to go more with blank cards and then write something about my caring. I've been thinking about you. I care about you. Even scripture can feel like a slap in the face for someone. You know, the Lord is your comfort or whatever. If the Lord doesn't feel like my comfort right now, then I feel like a fraud or I feel like I'm doing it wrong. So just be careful with affirmations. I mean, I give the idea of affirmations to people. I will say, you might find, you know, keep your eyes and ears open. There'll be a phrase or a statement that really seems to help. Maybe a piece of scripture will really guide you or comfort you. But for a particular one, if somebody is really in the depths of their pain. Is that, mm-hmm. You can fight me on that if you want. The Hallmark made lots of money with affirmations. But it can, like, people won't tell you, you know, they're not going to say, you know that card you sent?
I received a lot of sympathy notes and so forth when my husband died in June. And I think the ones that meant the most to me were the ones where they told of memories of happy times with together, our families together.
Yes, absolutely. Did everybody hear that? So to share something personal, you know, I heard that, you know, Bob has died. And, you know, I remember the time when we were at camp together, when we came to Holden in 1979. Something like that. Often those really touch. Rather than just say, remember God is your shield and your comfort and your enemy.
You know,
I know that. Did you want to say something?
Oh, I just get so upset with so many sympathy cards. Like, yes. I know they've gone to a better place. Well,
right.
You really don't at that point.
Yeah. Or that's not the issue. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. Tell me something I don't know. You know. Yeah. Okay. The next one. Time. Writing your loss. C.S. Lewis, in his wonderful book, A Grief Observed, which is really a journal, says that for him, writing his pain is a catharsis. It's like a pressure release. And that very often he would write and write and write passionately about something. Then the next day he'd read it and he'd say, this is a bunch of garbage. I don't believe this at all. But if he hadn't put it out, it would still be festering in there. And so often getting it out like that, writing it, and that's one reason I put a journal in the back of my book. Poetry for some people, creative writing, or drawing, other types of artwork really help. In, I'd say, Yes, God, I have the story of a Jewish man who said that he was denying being a Jew because to be a Jew, he thought, was to just be dumped on. And in all different ways, and yet God was wooing him. And the way it happened was he started writing poetry. He said he felt a strong urge within him to write poetry. He says, looking back on it, you know, it's very spiritual, this poetry, but he would have denied that vehemently at the time. You know, in fact, he said he was into psychology and he had nothing to do with spirituality. And yet, over the years, it took about 10 years of writing poetry, it really was kind of a formative for him in his spirituality. He kind of worked through a whole lot of issues, and he came to a place where he really realized God was speaking to him through that poetry. And he realized that it was a very Jewish way, because the poems were all about tradition and history, and it led him gently back to who he really was meant to be.
What was the title of the book? A Grief What?
A Grief Observed, okay, by C.S. Lewis. And I'm sure it's in the library. A lot of these.
Memory books. Tell you a story about John, a little boy, a 5-year-old, who came to me many years ago on a Sunday. I don't usually see people on Sunday, but the GP, who I knew, called me from a city about an hour and a half away, and he said, Nancy, he says, I'm having real difficulty. This little guy's granddad died over a month ago. I suggested to the parents that John be allowed to go to the funeral. He really wanted to, and they said, no, it'll hurt him. And they won't talk to John about his granddad, and John wants to, and I could just see him getting angrier and angrier. Well, this morning, he pushed his baby sister down a flight of stairs. She bounced, she's okay, but the parents say he is an angry little boy, and he can't live here anymore. You've got to put him in a child mental institution. And he says, I am not putting a normal kid, you know, even if I can find a child mental institution around here. But they are scared, and I can't get through to them. Would you see him? So I said, yeah, I'll see him. So we came down. Now I realized that I'd be saying the same thing to them that the GP had, and they weren't hearing him, they weren't going to hear me. I thought, okay, John's probably the most accessible. So normally I would see a child with their parents, with their family. But in this case, I asked to see him alone. And he came in and he was an angry little boy. He sat there with his arms crossed. And I said, your mummy told me that your granddad died. Now he was waiting for me to say something about the baby sister. So, yeah, he said, and that your granddad really loved you a lot. Well, I loved him too. Said, yeah, you loved each other a lot. And can I tell you some things that people often feel when someone they love dies? And I just mentioned sadness and loneliness. And I said anger. And he says, yep, they do. I said, well, I wonder what some of the things they feel angry about. They feel angry because they didn't get to go to the funeral. And they feel angry that nobody talks to them about their granddad. And I said, wow, that's a lot to be angry about. He says, yep. I said, you know, it's strange because some parents think that talking to children about someone who has died or letting them go to the funeral will make the children hurt worse. Would not. That's silly. Well, yeah, I kind of think so too. But so we started talking, and then I said, I'd really like to know more about your granddad. Oh, I could tell you. I said, well, I knew you could. But the issue I had was that if the pressure was taken off by seeing me, I knew he would be okay, but the parents wouldn't believe it, right? And so they needed to have the transformation that happened with them as well. So I said, I'd already heard a little bit about what he and his granddad had liked to do, and I said, I'd like to know a lot about granddad, but not through words. I'd like to see pictures of things that granddad liked or didn't like or things you did together. Do you know what a scrapbook is? He said, no, so I explained to him. I said, what I'd like you to do is get a scrapbook and cut out pictures from magazines or put in photographs or write things. He said, I don't write yet. Well, maybe an adult can write. If you tell them what to write. And I'd like to see you back here in 3 days. You think you could work on it really hard and get, oh yeah, I said, I could do that. He said, 3 days, come back and see me with your scrapbook. Okay. So then I said to mom and dad, got them in, and I said, I totally guarantee that he will not hurt the baby, because I'd also said to him, I need to have a deal with you. We need to shake hands on it. You don't hurt your baby sister. You don't hurt anybody for 3 days. Okay, he said. I'm going to be busy with my book. I said, yeah, I know. And he needed to do something that he put a lot of energy into. So I said, I totally guarantee he will not hurt the baby.
He's got some homework that is going to allow him to release these angry feelings. What's the homework, they said? He'll tell you. He's in charge of it. If you could just follow his directions, you absolutely guarantee, I totally guarantee it. You know, complain to me at the Psychological Association if he hurts the baby. Okay, so they took him home. 3 days later, Mom stuck her head in and she said, that is the most wonderful book. And you know, it took 45 minutes for him to choose the right scrapbook in the drugstore. He had to get the right cover. And he spent hours on that book. And you know, I've learned things about my dad that I didn't know. And we really like talking with him about it every evening. And she says, and I know our doctor had said we needed to talk to him, but we didn't believe him. Well, we believe him now, so we're very sorry. But it's a great book, and he sleeps with it under his pillow. And so I said, thank you. So he came in, and I said, don't say a word. Let me see your book. So I take the book, and I open it. And the first picture is a plate of spaghetti. And I said, Granddad really likes spaghetti. He said, yes. And he showed me that if you take one piece, and you go, and I turned the page and I said, there's another bowl of spaghetti here. This is supposed to be lasagna, but I couldn't find lasagna. So would you like me to write this is supposed to be lasagna? Yes, that would be a good idea, he said. Well, there were photographs that Mom had printed underneath what they were about. I said, Granddad likes sand. He says, no, that's the beach that Granddad would take me to. And he was teaching me to skip stones. And Mummy showed me that if you got to do it outside. If you put white glue down, and then you pour sand on, and then you tip it over, and some of it stays on. And it's like the beach. And there was a bit of one of his sweaters that was stuck on, and some kind of dried flowers. And it was just wonderful. Memory book. And he said, I took it to show and tell at school. And they asked me to some questions about Granddad. And then Sue came up to me after, and she said, my Granddad died too. So we talked about it. So he's already getting this community of support. So they chatted with each other. Wonderful. Well, so the parents said, got the message, I don't think we need to come back, and off we went. And Mom sent me a photograph of him that was in the local paper months later, springtime, and you know when they take a picture of a child with little ducks and chicks around, you know, first spring, and he was at a shopping mall, and he was playing with these little... They took a picture of him, and he just looked radiant. And she said, can you believe this is the same kid that we thought was going to have to be institutionalized? Well, you did, but... But so books like that, memory books, so poetry or journaling can really be helpful for some people. Oh dear, can I just gallop for a little bit more? Okay, let's go down to the next one. Spiritual practices, okay. All different kinds of prayers. Now, we've already talked somewhat about the Psalms, and I was going to do the 23rd Psalm, but I think I'm going to leave it because we don't have time. The Jewish people have a wonderful prayer when they say, sometimes, you know, trying to talk to God, we just can't get our words out. So use a moaning prayer. And it's just what it sounds like. And just moaning. And not trying for words, and just being with God in the pain, and it can be a wonderful release.
That's interesting.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it's a great prayer of just catharsis. Just let that through. A lot of people say, well, I don't pray. And I said, well, I think you probably do. You pray a lot, you just don't realize it. Anytime you go, oh God, Lord Jesus Christ, that's a prayer. No, you're doing it. Enter into it more fully, and you'll feel a response. Response is always being offered, you may not feel it. There's a prayer that I've developed. Those of you who do some kind of contemplative or centering prayer may be told in your tradition that when your mind moves away, is distracted, that you just gently bring it back when you remember to do that. Well, grieving people have a great difficulty doing that. They don't concentrate well.
And I say, God is everywhere, even in the distraction. So my prayer of distraction is when you find your mind going, trust that God is there and will direct you to some healing or some guidance, some comfort through that, if you just open to it more fully. So just be present in the distraction. So one woman said to me, she had tried that, and she said, I was sitting there and I was praying, and I got halfway through the Lord's Prayer when these teenagers drove by in a car with their boombox really loud. My mind went to them right away, and I started thinking, oh, those kids, now I'm going to have to start all over again because I can't remember where I was. And then, oh, but Nancy says, go with the distraction. Okay, these kids and what, and she says, and I kind of entered into that experience. So what I realized was God was saying to me, you need to move. You know, your body is tight and tense. You need to do some movement. Don't just sit there. And that kind of vital, you know, and you need music. And so what she did, she then went and put on some, it wasn't the same music they were playing, but some music, that, and she just kind of danced around the living room and cried and just felt like that was really what she was being invited to do for healing. So going with the distraction, where is God there? And what is God saying to us there? If our mind is moving to something, it may be God is inviting us to go to that place. Okay, further down, we're talking about different healing services. And many churches now have once a month or a service of healing. The prayer around the cross on Friday nights is so powerful if you haven't experienced that yet. Many churches have Taizé services with chanting and a prayer or laying on of hands. What our church did 1.5 Lents ago is we have a healing ministry in the church, Healing Touch, and we were wanting it to be more visible. And so during Lent, after people received communion, they were invited to go to the back of the church where there were couples who they could either sit or they could kneel or they could stand, say what they wanted healing around or just not say anything and just have the laying on of hands and that healing. And we really wondered how it was going to be. We thought that the service, the 9:15 with the younger people, we'd probably get quite a few people, which we did. We got nearly everybody from the more traditional service. It was really interesting. And in fact, so many people came, we had to do 4 more songs than we would normally be doing. And people really wanted that. They wanted that touch, they wanted that sense that, you know, there's healing, God is healing through this as well as through Eucharist. And so we've done that once a month now. We will offer that. Different kinds of worship services too, particularly for healing. What do we have next? Retreats, or we can go right to the end, I think that's the retreats or spiritual direction. Thank you. Coming here, going to other retreat centers that might have a particular program around loss or something on patients, focus on patients, or just have making a private undirected retreat or directed retreat where there's not a specific focus. Spiritual direction, talking about your spirituality. Gary, who's here, is seeing a lot of people for spiritual direction. Helping others. Don't make assumptions. One, if someone's been helpful to you, it may be helpful to someone else, but it may not. One woman said to me, just after Christmas, I came home after visiting my daughter for a few days and I found on my back step 10 turkey casseroles. She said, A, I don't like turkey. B, I don't have a freezer. I want to just grieve the loss of my husband, but I'm trying to figure out what am I going to do with these things. Plus, she said, there's 10 friends sitting at home thinking, I've been helpful. I call that the helping hand strikes again. Like out of their compassion, they're trying to be helpful, but they haven't checked it out. It's so easy just to say, I'm making turkey casseroles today. Would you like one? Or, you know, or just put it in the freezer and check when she gets back. And then she can say, thank you for the thought. Let it remain a thought. So either asking, what can I do to be helpful? I'm not sure what to do. Fine, the person can tell you, or maybe they can tell you what they don't want. Or make a suggestion, but don't be invested in it. You know, if I say, well, I'm baking this afternoon, you know, it's my famous quiche. You love my quiche, I know you do. So would you like one? It's really hard for the person to say no. But if I say, I'm doing some baking this afternoon, or I could look after your kids tonight, or I could, you know, a number of things, then you're not invested in a particular way of helping. Much easier for the person to say, oh, yes to this, no to this, or to give you a suggestion. Don't say, call me anytime. I'll be there for you whenever. Because that's not true. It can't be true. People are afraid they're going to phone you up and you'll say, oh, sure, yeah, just shh, quiet. Yeah, no, I could do it. No, I wouldn't be able to because I've got to work help. You know. No. But if I could say, I'm working days, but every evening except Tuesday, this night is free, I'd really like to come over or do something for you if that would help. Person's more likely to take me up on it. If you can show you have limits and will look after yourself, then the grieving person doesn't feel they have to look after you. Because what the grieving person is afraid is that you're going to go past your limits and crash, and they're going to feel guilty. So much better to say, no, I'm not able to do that. I am able to do this. Oh, good. You know, I can trust you there. Use the grapevine if you want to help others or yourself. Every community, churches are particularly good with grapevines, right? There is at least one person in every church congregation that if you give some information to, particularly if you say, this is not common knowledge, right? Everybody in that church community knows. And so if somebody is, say, back east for a funeral, and you know somebody could contact them and say, when you come back, or the first Sunday back, or is there something we can do? How would you like us to be? Do you want us to bring it up? Do you want us to wait till you do? The person can give some direction. That can go through the grapevine. Most people are quite relieved to know what to do. There's always a few that know better, right? But you know. But most people will say, okay, good. I'm going to wait till she brings it up. And then the grieving person feels much better. I do that with kids a lot. You know, you're going back to school now after this has happened. Some people know and some people don't. Let's do a bit of role play on what you might say to people, how you'd like to be. And is there someone that you could tell that could spread the word? Yeah, my best friend. She would tell everybody. Okay. And then the best friend feels really good that she's got a job to do. Mm-hmm. So using that grapevine. And then the last point I just want to make is it's way more important to listen than to talk. You know, I've been talking for a while. Just to be there with someone. We don't need to fix it. Men particularly really want to fix the problem. And often we'll say, you know, they feel so helpless because they're, you know, they're listening to a woman and they're thinking, I've got to say something that shed some light on this or that fix it. And the woman's saying, I just want to be heard. I just want to know that you are interested and not to take it away and to just allow that. And so listening is important, but also letting people grieve the way they want to. Some people need to just go out and work it off. They don't want to talk a lot. Other people need to sit and talk for a long time. So realizing people are different. Tomorrow we're going to look at ritual and how we can use rituals, not just like the funeral and memorial service, but rituals for other types of loss, for transitions in our life, and what elements need to be in those to make them helpful. And we'll probably talk about some other things too, because I haven't given you time for questions today. But thank you.